everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tales from a Vet Tech with me, Tabitha Kucera. Today, we are talking to registered veterinary technician Robin Post all about how low-cost care should not mean low-quality care and more. So enjoy the interview, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. I'm so stoked to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
So as you heard from the intro, Robin is amazing. I'm a little biased, but she is doing such important work, and it's where the shelter and veterinary field really needs to be going faster. But again, we focus on the positive at Tales from a Vet Tech, and we are getting there because of lovely people like Robin. So I figured we could get started, because I know your path to opening Animal Fix Clinic was a long path. So if you want to just let me know a little bit about your career path as a registered veterinary technician and how you opened Animal Fix Clinic.
Yeah. So it's kind of a second career. I was doing paralegal type work forever.
Whoa. I did not know
yeah,
that.
Which was very strange, and it was boring. I always wanted to work with animals, but I didn't know how, because you can't work with them without experience, and you can't get experience without right. working with them. So I started volunteering at the San Francisco SPCA, and they stuck me in the ringworm ward, which was also the URI ward. And back then the URI was treated with humidifiers with menthol. So it was like a Woo! Little corner room with lime sulfur and menthol humidifiers. And I loved it because I just got to hang out with the cats. Mm. So I learned a lot about shelter medicine. And then I went into the spay-neuter clinic one day because someone called out sick. So they just threw me in. And that's how I learned, which was super scary. So I didn't really know what I was doing. I just kind of did what I was told, but didn't understand it. And someone mentioned I should go on a RAVS trip. So I don't know if you're familiar with RAVS. RAVS is the Rural Area Veterinary Services.
Oh, which, yes.
Goes out to reservations and provides spay-neuter for the communities out there, and wellness and parvo treatment and whatever they need. And it teaches veterinary students. So veterinary students come as well. So that's kind of where I learned all the basics and all the foundation for anesthesia. And then luckily was very supported to bring that back to the SPCA and continued in spay-neuter there, continued in shelter medicine there. And then the SPCA sent me and Dr. Goh, who you met, our medical director, who was also the medical director of the spay-neuter clinic at the SPCA, to a shelter in a place called Stockton, which is like Central Valley, California, which is a rough area. And they had like a 13% live release rate. So, and all of the animals we were taking in from there were breaking with parvo and distemper. So we were like, let's just go check it out. So our role was kind of to set up a spay-neuter clinic there and hire a staff. But I think that was kind of the game changer for me as far as the path I wanted to take, because I don't think I'd ever really seen a high kill shelter and what that looks like. And it is just, the morning is euthanasia.
Yeah.
And it is just super cute dogs being walked, think they're going on a walk because they don't get to get out. They're going on a walk and they're wagging and they're going to be euthanized. And there is a pile of dead dogs. And every morning you have to make space because they come in all day. So every day you have to make space. Even during the day, as one comes in, one has to go out. So I was like, why are all these dogs even here? Why is there 300 dogs here? These are all super nice dogs. They had somebody. What happened? Right. And same with the cats. The cats were not getting out. They weren't getting transferred out because they had Panluke. And I'm like, who are all these cats? Why are all these cats here? So I also met up with someone called Lori Weiss, who runs Downtown Dog Rescue in LA. It's not really a rescue, but she was like the first person to just sit in front of the shelter and say, why are you walking in here with your animal? And if I could give you medical care, would you keep it? Keep your pet? And everyone's
pet
like, absolutely.
Retention.
I just can't afford
resolving
it.
Solving kind of, problems, identifying issues. What?
In my mind, like, I feel like she created it. She even has a book of how to do it. And so many people, she let me sit outside with her one day so I could see it. And I just sat outside the LA shelter with her. And all day someone would walk up with a cute cat and she would say, why are you surrendering? And she's like, her leg's broken. I went to the vet. I can't even afford the exam. And she's like, no problem. I can get you in to get an amputation somewhere tomorrow. And this is after years of her networking and setting that all up. That takes a while, but she had every single person that walked up, she got them somewhere. It was almost all medical. And so everything changed for me there. And I was like, I know someone has to spay and neuter all these shelter animals, but I want to keep them out.
Right.
So if there is something surgical that can be done to keep them with their people, or prevent economic euthanasia, that's what I want to do. So there was a place called Fix Our Ferals that mostly did these giant MASH clinics that didn't have a brick and mortar. They would go to Oakland and do those giant MASH clinics out of whatever shelter would let them.
Right.
And then they finally got a brick and mortar. They got up and running and then they kind of went out of business. They lost the funding. So their board got some money to start back up and asked me and Dr. Go to be on the board. And while we were on the board, there was no clinic yet. It was just to get up and running. And we were like, if you were to get up and running again, besides spay neuter, would you be doing these pyometras, dystocias, and nucleations, things that our animals are actually being euthanized for or surrendered for? And they said, yeah, no problem. And so then we just one day we're like, they said, we know we need to hire a vet and we need to hire a staff. And one day we were just like, should we just do it? Should we just quit our very secure, safe jobs and open a clinic with having no idea how to do it?
Right.
And we did it. And we'll be 5 years in April. It's a total dream come true. We've never once turned anyone away for lack of funds. Sometimes we will just do the surgery and figure it out later if it's that bad. And we don't have anyone that says no to us. I mean, a lot comes with that, but it's 100% worth it. And that's why we're here now. And we hired basically I interviewed techs in an empty building and I said, I promise this is real. I promise
this is not a Craigslist place.
You're safe.
Yeah.
You're safe here. And then I said, this is not going to be my clinic and Dr. Go's clinic. This will be our clinic. So it'll be whatever we make it. And almost every single person is still with us. So that's how we got here.
That is amazing. And I love that so much because I think both of us are very similar in the fact that we saw very concerning patterns that ethically we were losing sleep over it. I'm sure many other people were. Animals and humans were suffering because people don't want to relinquish their animals. People don't want to euthanize their animals due to behavior or medical issues. And we were like, let me ask why. Why? Like, venting is healthy, guys, but also problem solving. Mm-hmm. So asking why, and I didn't know your whole story. And I fucking love that. That is just amazing. And how a few people played a really big part into where you are now. And now, Robin works Fix Our Ferals, but you recently have changed your name to Animal Fix Clinic.
Yes.
And Animal Fix Clinic is the first fear-free, certified, high quality veterinary care accessible to all type practice, because I don't want to necessarily say spay neuter clinic because they do quite a lot more there. And when I met them as a fear-free practice certification consultant, I just happened to be their consultant. It fate y'all. Cause I know not many vet techs work in the worlds that me and Robin do. And the ones that do, mad props, we love you. I mean, we love everybody, but I remember because something that really clicked with us immediately was like, accessible care shouldn't be lower quality care. And unfortunately, as a whole in our fields, low cost care is not great care overall, which I understand finances and things like that. But when we really look at it, I think the reasons why are different because, for example, there'll be certain medications that are safer to pre-med, but are either the similar cost or less than what the clinic may be using. So finances do not play as big of a part as people would think. So I was so touched by you and what you guys are doing at Animal Fix Clinic and really changing the narrative and working to change like veterinary low cost care and making it not only accessible to all, but providing high quality care, because just because you may not have the funds does not mean you are less than. And I don't think it's malicious on some parts when it's someone offering low cost care, but I think there's lots of biases and other things that are contributing to that. Obviously, it's a complex issue, but I do think that low cost care, in some cases, it's better if they actually lose money. And if they would have went to routine veterinarian, they actually would have gotten diagnosed earlier and had the issue addressed and saved money. But again, we're going to have a whole separate episode on that because I can go on and on and on.
I think there's some corners you can cut and some you can't. And I think there's your deal breakers you're going to have. Like, what things are you okay with and what right. things are you not okay with? Like, if the cheaper gauze that week isn't the great gauze, it's fine. But we're not right. going to say, you know, the opioid is too expensive. We're going to skip the pain meds this week. Right. It's like there's some corners you can cut and some you can't. Like,
no, I definitely, I
we
mean,
don't the buy care, the cheap blades. Exactly. We buy the good blades.
I work with low-cost vaccine clinics and I offer... the same, I talk to them the same way I do when I'm working in like a GP. And yes, I may provide them with even more options, but I'm going to explain that to them. I'm going to talk to them just like I would talk to anyone else. And if they can't afford an option, which is 100% understandable, we're going to talk about how we can best help the issue with what we have. Because in many cases, we can do quite a lot, actually, from experience for me. And I'm sure you see that as well. But I love that you mentioned that because fear-free is all about, of course, addressing the emotional and physical well-being of the animal, but that includes pain management. And I almost started crying during the consult because I think I asked a question, some scenario type question about if an animal is exhibiting some signs of stress in a cage or something like that. And one of the first things you said was, I would address pain. And make sure that, and I just was like, I never hear this from low cost care. And in many cases, you know, animals are being spayed and no pain meds are being, like you said, I understand there's places to cut corners, but pre-meds.
That's not one of them.
Yeah. And pain medication, mm-hmm. like that isn't necessarily one of them. And when I hear things like the client declined it, I'm like, guys, if you're saying this costs more money, we need to present it in a way that's appropriate. But
yeah, we see a lot of people that will get a lot of records for things that will show that the animal didn't get a pain medication. And one time I just called and I was like, I just want to clarify that this cat didn't get anything. And they're like, that's correct. The pain meds are extra. So that makes it an option. And I just don't think it's optional. Like it's right. not an option. You're not having surgery without pain medication. So, and there's pain medication can be anything. It could be multimodal, anything. Right. Like if you don't have opioids from the shortage, we have CRIs, we have local blocks, we have NSAIDs, we have everything else we can do. But just to not give anything because that's not a part of the price and it's extra, especially if you don't even know you're supposed to ask for it, which most people don't.
Exactly.
They have no idea. And so if they didn't ask for it, they don't get it. So having it not be part of the package to me is the beginning of a lot of it. It's like the spay is the package comes with the vaccine and the microchip, but it comes with the pain medication and the local block and the anti-inflammatory. That's not extra. And it's not something you have to ask for or request or know that you're supposed to do that. And to me, that's like, it shouldn't be any other way.
Yeah. And clients trust us. I mean, I work in those settings and in many cases after the fact, we may talk about it and they're like, I was under the impression that they were fine. Mm-hmm. So once I explain, you know, a spay
is they can get in. Yeah. Sometimes they can get so much of one, like they could get a whopping dose of ACE and seem fine because they're mostly unconscious.
Right. From the client's perspective,
they seem comfortable.
Yeah. And it's kind of like when I see someone ask something like, should we muzzle your dog? For example, that's a thing for me. To me, we should be aware of body language and assessing that and how to interact with because I love basket muzzles. Basket muzzles are great. Safety first. But sometimes I'll see somebody asking the client and they are completely unaware of how to assess body language. Maybe it's a specific breed. I'm going to be honest with y'all. This is what I see. Biases exist. I have it too. And I'm just like, that's not the client's job. They just like, when I bring my car to the car shop, see, I don't even know what it's called, mechanic. Mm-hmm. I trust them to tell me what's wrong because I don't know shit about. Mm-hmm. That is not my expertise. I trust them. And I think when it comes, like you said, to pain meds or whatever it may be, they trust us, and it's our job to provide them with, just like you said, that's part of it. They, they don't have a choice because we need to do that. Right. And also, how many animals are we seeing coming from these hospitals where pain meds weren't given, and maybe wind up pain wasn't addressed, all this stuff possibly. And then the animal rips their sutures out, and now we have a severe issue that the client definitely cannot afford. I mean, in many cases, the reason why an animal is chewing at their sutures is because they're painful.
Or they had such a scary, whatever the experience was, right, that now they're coming to us and this alligator rolling just at the side of the front door. And we're like, what happened here?
Yeah. And that's something too, that you shared so many beautiful stories about, because as veterinary professionals who love fearful animals, because I understand it's not everyone's cup of tea, we tend to see animals that have been seen by a lot of other veterinary professionals and maybe have even been fired from some veterinary clinics due to the fear aggression that they and the client didn't feel capable. Lots of, again, lots of context. And these stories that you shared of working with not only the animal, but the client, and the critical thinking and the amazing ways you guys were like, we can sedate you safely like this. Maybe we're going to sedate you in the car. Maybe we're going to sedate you with a butterfly as your mom or dad is walking you around the parking lot. And it's just so, I mean, it's great for me to see critical thinking when it comes to handling ever, but especially in the kind of environment where you are, where I'm sure both of us, there's a very big misconception that with faster care, for example, like a low-cost vaccine, I have 5 minutes with each person, or the work you do, that, you know, fear-free or low-stress handling, these things aren't realistic. When I actually say, if I didn't have these skills, half of these animals wouldn't be seen. And and I can get every thing done. Now, I have to have those skills first. Practice makes perfect. That's not how I started. But could you share a few of beautiful stories about clients? Because you also shared a lot of stories about how, of course, a lot of clients have big families and they would come to you not only because your veterinary care was affordable, but also they were like, I didn't feel like this was like one of those factory lines. I felt like I was listened to. I felt like a human. My dog or my cat did great. And then you're like, I love this. Now I'm seeing all of their animals and we're getting them medical care.
Yeah. I think a lot of times, like, you just, I mean, we do over 40 check-ins within an hour in the morning, but it doesn't mean that we just take your animal and go.
Right.
I mean, we really just, even if it's quick, we're making sure they understand what's happening. We're making sure that they understand the procedure. We're making sure that we answer any questions. And my favorite thing now is if we get an email that's like, hey, my dog has been rejected from his other clinics because of his behavior. I'm like, those are my favorite now, because because now it's like, I think of what we used to do. Like, we used to pull the leash through the door and
right,
like slam them behind the door and basically like choke them. And I was like, we thought that was the only way. We like, right, this is our last resort. This is the only thing we can do. And so now it's so nice, because I think what people really struggle with is the fact that they cannot listen to the dog or do a physical exam, and they're too afraid to proceed with anesthesia, not being able to even at least listen to their heart and their lungs. But if you just talk to the owners and just say, hey, we cannot listen to your dog. Your dog might have a whopping heart murmur. We don't know, but chances are, even if your dog does, we're going to still use the same protocol, because a micro dose of dextromethor in your dog that's lunging is safer than if we try to wrangle this dog to the ground with all of us wrestling it. So much lower stress, and the stress is so much worse on the heart than this tiny little dose of dextromethor and ketamine, and whatever opioid we're going to give in a small volume, quick poke in the muscle after we have had your family drive you in the truck down the block, down the street, away from the rest of the parking lot, giving you some peanut butter and gabapentin and trazodone, waited for the rest of the check-ins to be done. And then we just poke you with a little bit in the car, even if you have to, and even if I say, hey, like, we're going to keep an eye on your dog from outside the car, and the second his head goes down, we'll grab him, and we have everything set up and the tubes are ready, and we'll listen to him when he's out, but he is not going to get a physical exam beforehand. And they're like, no problem.
Yeah. And just I think explain that, it. Yeah. That honesty and transparency and real talk. I mean, we work with really fearful animals. Mm-hmm. And these animals, especially in the case of accessible care, in many cases, these animals haven't been seen by a vet ever.
Yeah.
Because they don't have access to veterinary care, or they may have even been shamed or made to feel bad that they had a pet, mm-hmm. Which is, whoa, is that dark? So they're even afraid to bring their animal to a veterinarian. So I do think, I mean, that's how medicine is. We work with each individual animal. And like you said, we want to do what we can to reduce fear and stress. And you are very aware of everything. Mm-hmm. And not only are you aware of all that, but you are communicating with the client, which I think is so important. And again, that really stuck with me when you said that clients say how great you guys are, and then their whole families come with their animals. And I just thought that that was one of the most beautiful things I've heard, because I think sometimes in vet med guys, I know I'm a unicorn that loves all the things, the humans, the kids, the animals, but sometimes we love animals, but not people so much, and maybe don't communicate in a way the client can understand, which results in the client maybe saying something like, they didn't even examine my animal. And then we get upset. Mm-hmm. But from the client's perspective, you put a hand on their animal, you did examine them, but that's not what they saw. So if we communicated that, they would understand not only that this is a relationship we're working together, but also the value of you as a veterinarian or a veterinary professional.
And they like to help. Like, if you just say, hey, like, we can't even, like, even if we have the great plan where we're going to let your dog calm down in the truck down the street, sedate them with you, sometimes even these people are a little bit scared of their dog.
Yeah.
And so we'll just say, plan B is we have a giant collapsible crate. It's already pre-weighed. You will just walk your dog into the crate, shut the door, and we will weigh the whole thing, subtract the weight of the crate, and we will just induce them through the muscle on the side of the crate. They'll go to sleep and they'll wake up in there. Next thing they know is you coming to get them, and they don't even know anybody actually touched them. And they're like, yeah, whatever will help, because I think that they get embarrassed also.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's not, I mean, like, I have untouchable chihuahuas. It just is what it is. So, and also they're so relieved that it's done and it's over.
Yeah.
And then they're like, well, I have one at home that's actually worse, but we brought the nice one. And then all of a sudden, like, they're bringing everybody because it went okay. And they were like, how many do you have? How many are there? And they're like, oh, we don't want to say. And I'm like, it's totally fine. Yes. We're not going to tell anybody. And we don't care how anybody acts. Just tell us and we'll get them all done. So.
And that meshable carrier or crate technique is very similar, because people are a little more familiar with the mesh carrier, where you have the client bring a cat in a mesh carrier.
Yeah, I am not good at that.
You apply a very gentle pressure or even a towel and inject the cat through the mesh carrier. So
yeah, the other techs are really good at that. I, for some reason, I get panicky because I'm like, I cannot tell for sure that that's the thigh. And I'm like, am I injecting into your abdomen? I can't. And everyone else is really good at it. And I'm just like,
and that's where we all have our pros and cons, yeah. Like, which is why, yep, I love teams, because nobody's good at everything. So yeah, we can, yep, like,
and we have one that's really good at when you can kind of just with the hard side of carrier with the holes.
Oh, I love that.
I cannot do it. I can't do it. So I just, like, there's one person who's really good at it. There's one person really good at the mesh. There's one person really good at taking the top off and making a little burrito. So everyone has the thing that they're really good at, and we call everybody into the thing they're good at.
Love it. So I know that your kind of motto for your clinic is that every animal and every family deserves the best veterinary care, and that you guys are dedicated to making high quality veterinary care accessible to all. So I wanted to kind of briefly discuss, because not everyone is aware, and I totally understand that, some of the challenges that your clients face, including not having accessibility to care, financial, and then kind of addressing that myth that thankfully I'm hearing less of, but I still hear a concerning amount, that poor people should not have pets, and other very stigma, like essentially like stigmatizing unjustly people who may not financially, and again, who defines poor, all that stuff, but kind of stigmatizing people with not as many funds as maybe someone else, and saying not, they shouldn't have pets, and even shaming them, mm-hmm, and making them feel like they're bad caregivers just due to the fact that they don't have access to tons of funds.
I mean, in that case, that would make me someone who shouldn't deserve a pet, because I mean, if you think about it,
no, I'm just kidding.
It's true. Like, I mean, if I was to, the estimates I see, I could not afford on a daily basis. And that would make me somebody who didn't deserve to have a pet, if that's how we're defining it. So if we are defining it by whether or not you could afford emergency surgery if it were to happen and you have that amount in your savings, if only those people get a pet, then I wouldn't be able to have all these pets. So I don't think what you can afford really has anything to do with whether or not you deserve to have a pet. We have people that will do whatever it takes to get to the clinic. And it could be two different BARTs, two different buses, their friend picking them up somewhere to give them a ride. So I think one huge issue is transportation. Yeah. So it's hard for people to even deal with transportation. And that's usually after trying to find transportation to the emergency, taking a day off of work if necessary to get to us or get to the emergency clinic. So transportation is huge. And just, I mean, honestly, the issue I see mostly is you have an unexpected emergency with your pet and you go to the ER and you can't afford to do it there, because if you do it there, they have to call in a boarded surgeon.
Right.
And that's for most people not accessible. So then most people don't have a regular GP because, a lot of people don't have a GP. So it's like, right, you basically are seen when you have an emergency and that's kind of it. There's not really a GP to send you to. So it's usually us, or, there's a couple other places, but, they do have a little bit longer of a wait because you do have to kind of go through a process, right, to apply. So that's another barrier, is some lengthy, application processes when you're having an emergency. And that's hard. And it's just mostly financial and transportation. We luckily don't have any kind of extensive process to apply for grants or funding. So it's mostly financial, and it's crazy because these animals don't care. They don't, yeah, care if you live in the van that you came in. The van's awesome. And we have so many people that just don't even have an address, or, yeah, they have that van and that van is super cool. And
that animal is their everything.
And that person is everything to them. And, yes, we have so many animals that come in for non-spay neuter surgeries that just stare at the door. They stare at the door because that's where they last saw their person. And every time I take a dog, like if we have a dog that's a pio or dystocia or nucleation, whatever, I take them out to see if they're making urine, if they can pee, and they always know exactly where their person had parked. And they always go right back to that spot. And if there's another car, they try to get in that car, and they always know where their person was. They don't care if that person has the money to pay for it. That doesn't make them a deserving owner. That's just their person and they love them. And I don't know who we are to decide whether or not that is good pet ownership or not.
No, I completely understand. And I grew up in East Cleveland, which very low, very below the poverty line. My mom is amazing and worked her ass off, and still the whole below the poverty line. And I know no one's surprised because I became a veterinary technician, but I had quite a lot of animals growing up. And that's the case, at least in my experience, with a lot of, when I'm offering or working at a low cost wellness clinic or something along those lines, many of those people had similar experiences to me where there were cats and dogs everywhere and like just strays, whatever we want to call them. And we would bring them in. And I know I had quite a few cats, and most of the people I work with have quite a few cats because they're like, I just want to provide for them and help them. And and in some cases it might just be providing food and shelter, which with feral cats, that's what we should be doing. And of course, not bringing them into our home, but they were doing the best with the minimal resources they had. They would put them all into animal care. And now, obviously, I know a lot more than I did as like a 12 or 13 year old. But I also know that with my dogs and my cats and my bunny and my turtle, yes, you guys, that my mom was doing the best she could. And we all love those animals so much. And it's made me the person I am today. And we had no money. Mm-hmm. it is interesting. Again, I'm hearing it less, which is wonderful, but I definitely think that's something that we need to destigmatize essentially and help to break this. Because another thing I think is sometimes I don't think even in GP, so not in the kind of practice you're in, but in GP, sometimes I think we may look at someone and based on what car they're driving or what clothes they're wearing offer them specific treatment plans versus offering them all of the, like you would with every person. By offering them all of the care ABC. I think that that happens more commonly than men. Sometimes we might not even realize we're doing it. So I think you brought up some really great points. And again, you have so many amazing stories of your clients. I feel like there should be a book or something. Have each of them like individualized, like smiling with their pet. Oh my God, I would love that. Robin.
I did. I made a book for Dr. Go's birthday. It's just all
did
the different.
You? Oh yeah, my God.
All the people going back when they're done with surgery and the owner, like my favorite moment. Like it's not that I'm only talking about dogs, but I don't obviously let cats walk out to their car.
Oh no, you're good.
See their owner. But when the, my favorite moment is like these dogs that are really sick. So we do have a lot of like closed piles and ruptured dystocias, and they're really, really sick. And we're always like, oh gosh, I hope they get through this. And you'll see the person up across the way. Like I just live for the moment I'm walking them out and they're still a little groggy, but then it clicks and they see them or hear them. And then they just pick up their step a little bit and a little extra pep in their step, and they see their person, and then everything's okay again.
That would be an awesome fundraiser. I would just take all my money if you did like a book, like a coffee table book. Hey guys out there, anybody who's good at photography and wants to help, I need this to happen now, because I think that would be amazing.
Yeah, it's just it makes everything worth it. And I just don't think, like, I used to be the same way. Like, I remember somebody brought in their dog or their cat in a plastic bag, and I was like, oh my God, we have to take this cat away from this lady.
Yeah.
And because I used to always think that, because I was like, she doesn't have a carrier.
I thought, and I now had someone like, come in cares? With a book bag, and I was like, yeah, what is that? Fine. And this was a long time ago.
Yeah. Oh yeah. This is like 15 years ago.
But now I'm like, a lot of people don't even have access to leashes. And instead of offering them a
cat carrier costs.
Yeah. And instead of offering them a leash and or a cat carrier and having a conversation with them, we say animal control, take their animals. And I'm pet retention should really, especially, I mean, in vet med, but also definitely in animal welfare, pet retention. Yeah.
We had someone bring like whatever they bring them in now. I'm like, that's so creative. We'll probably send them home in something different, but this is really creative. This duct tape stroller is.
Because I mean, the thing is, people, they're like, I really want to get my animal in here. And they might, again,
whatever it takes.
Not even have access to a leash or a carrier. Or like in East Cleveland growing up, most of the dogs weren't on leashes. So that wasn't even a known thing. You know what I mean? Yep. Like it's not, but again, I think it's harder for people to understand if they don't experience it, which is why we're talking about it.
Yeah.
So this may be a hard question, but Robin's got it. What is a piece or multiple pieces of advice to colleagues who are working in similar situations? Because obviously there's challenges with everything, and there's different challenges with what you're dealing with versus what other people are. But what piece of advice would you give to colleagues who are working in similar situations, like shelters, low-cost spay-neuter clinics, to advocate for their patients and practice good medicine, i.e. kind of start to implement positive changes?
I think I've been super, super lucky. I've always worked with really supportive veterinarians. I mean, not always, but for the most part,
they have a great team.
I've always worked with very, very supportive wherever I've been. Like, and I know I went to an anesthesia conference once where we learned all these different things, and they said, now how many of you are going to be able to take this back to your work and actually implement this? And nobody raised their hand. And I was like, oh, I can totally take this back to my work and say, I just learned this local block. Can we try it? And it's totally supported. If it's progressive and it's better for the animal, I'll go for it. So I've always worked in that environment. But I know a lot of people don't, and I have before for small chunks of time. And I think, change is super, super hard and super scary, especially in a high volume setting. You just cannot slow down. And anything that anyone brings up is just going to slow us down. And I think if as a group, you're just like, this is going to slow us down for sure in the beginning, because we have to learn it. It's new and it's different. But it's only going to slow us down for a little bit, for a couple times. And then we're going to be like, oh my God, this is so much easier. Why were we doing it the other way? So I think the fear-free comes into that too, because I didn't know what fear-free was. I didn't understand what was happening. I went on one of those RAVS trips, and one of the doctors was playing this music, and I was like, what is she doing? And then like they were giving vaccines to dogs, but they were smearing cheese on the wall, and the dogs were licking the cheese and giving the vaccines. And I was like, what's going on? And then one of our techs, I think you talked to Alex. I noticed she's really good at behavior. And we have these big dogs and she would just mumble touch gradient. I was like, what is she talking about? And so I was like, what are you doing? What is touch gradient? And she was like, oh, I did the fear-free certification. And so I was like, I'm just going to do it because everything, all these things I'm seeing is really positive.
Yeah.
So I did it. And one thing you really address is that what about if you're in the clinic that doesn't want to do it? What if not everyone's on board? And what was easy for us, because we're small, it was to say, like, we're all going to have to be on board. We're not going to have some people doing fear-free here and some people scruffing cats. We're all doing it. And everyone's like, that's great. So that wasn't an issue for us, but I can see it being a big issue for some people, because there's no time to slow down and some people just don't want to do it. So I think you have a lot of information about what do you do in those scenarios. But also what I think was really positive about the fear-free when I started it is that there's so much about pain management and multimodal anesthesia. And Tamara Grubb, who's my total idol.
Mine too. Bow down, guys.
Yeah, she does. she's an anesthesiologist that will talk about testicular blocks and demonstrate testicular blocks because none of us are above a testicular block.
Yeah.
And everyone deserves it. Yeah, it's true. And she did a whole, there's a whole section in there about pain management and anesthesia and pre-medication and multimodal anesthesia. And that is part of becoming even level one certified. So I think if people could even just say, hey, this is, everyone's kind of doing it right now. Why don't we get fear-free certified? That comes with it. And then all of a sudden you don't want to be the one scruffing the cat. Cause
it's
just changing the culture
and your perspective,
of the whole place.
It's helping you see things. Cause again, that's what learning is about, right? Like I used to do things now that makes, which I'm sure all of us, I used to do things now that makes me nauseous.
Oh yeah. I learned everything the wrong way. Everything I know how to do is because I was doing something wrong or didn't know better.
Trial and error learning, guys.
Yeah. So the fear-free just had so much stuff about just how important the anesthesia is and the analgesics and the pain medication and the anxiolytics and
here are
proper
some
pre-med.
Yeah.
And it's like, and there's doses and there's charts. And it kind of makes it just like unacceptable to not, I mean, I'm not saying you have to be fear-free, but unacceptable to not be, to ignore the fear, anxiety, and stress. So if you see a FAS of 3 or 4 that you stop and reassess, and that's okay now when it didn't used to be, you used to have to push through, cause there's too much to do. So also the pain medication, the medications, the anti-anxiety medications, the pain medications, it kind of makes, so once you've gone through the course, if you are fear, anxiety, stress scoring, if you're pain scoring, if you're going to score them, you have to do something about it. So you can't just give someone a pain score of 3 and then move on, or give someone a FAS score of 4 and then move on. That makes you address it. So I think getting everybody on board with that kind of thing, even if you don't become certified, is super helpful. And then it just becomes really normal. And really strange to have done it differently.
No, I always scream like FAS, basically body language scores or fear, anxiety, and stress scores for every animal, every time, and pain scores. And I work with shelters across the country and they are all about it. Like once we work together to teach them, obviously don't just say use the score and that's not great teaching. We have to help them apply it and make sure that my body language 3 is their 3 and this doctor's pain score is similar to my pain score. But
which can be hard because I had a hard time with pain scoring.
No, it is. It's like you said, it's very challenging to implement. It's like with a smaller staff, it's a little easier to get everyone on the same page. But once you do that, those tools are invaluable. Like it's just because again, such a big part. I lectured at I should remember what it's called, you guys. I'm the worst. I lectured at an amazing shelter conference in Tennessee yesterday. And I was talking about pain management and how FAS increases anesthetic dosages. And I'm like, we shouldn't have SIBO-5 on for a cat's bay. but in many, like that is something in my experience, I have seen. And now I understand that no one was addressing the fear, anxiety, and stress. Pre-meds were most likely not the most appropriate. So they may think it's just normal to have a cat on SIBO-5 for a spay procedure, which again, now that we have accessibility to all these resources, like you mentioned, and I say this all the time, we call it practicing vet med and shelter med because we're always improving, which is why all of us nerds in this field love it. We love being challenged. We love continuing to learn and we love animals. So, and as far as a piece of advice from my perspective is, I have the pleasure of going through to numerous places and doing wellness clinics at some places I'm not as familiar with. And I'm, no matter what, no matter where I'm at, whether I'm vaccinating a cat in a closet at a foster home, a rescue foster home, I should clarify, I am not vaccinating children. Or if I'm working in GP or whatever, I am always doing everything in my power to minimize fear and stress and provide the best quality care to that patient. And I can't tell you the amount, like there's a local place I work with who they're amazing. And I would do the vaccine clinics and wellness clinics a lot. And they literally asked me, why don't the animals scream as much with you? Because I had to give microchips. Ideally, we're going to be doing those under, again, this is where situation specific, guys, right? Yeah. Ideally, we're going to do those if they're spayed or neutered, but in some cases they are already.
Yep.
And I
hate that. I hate microchipping.
I use topical lidocaine. I use considered approach. I squeeze a toy as I put the microchip. I mean, there's a lot of creative things, again, critical thinking. And they were like, their mouths were dropping and watching me. And so basically through showing, no matter what, even if you feel alone, first off, you're not, we love you. We know it's hard to implement positive change. Don't give up, break it down into small pieces. Don't throw everything at once. Cause that's, even for someone that means well, like Robin said, change is hard. And I was that person a long time ago where I was like, this is awesome. And we have to do this and this and this. And then I shut them down. So we should break it down into small pieces, but also understand that you are leading through example always. And people, first off, you're keeping yourself safer, but you feel better from a ethical standpoint, but also you're always showing people through learning. And that's not just the way we interact with human or animals, but it's also the way we interact with clients. Like it makes a big difference because again, I used to say things like that client's not compliant because, and now from a behavior standpoint, I'm like, they didn't know what pain looked like. So that's why they didn't give the pain meds, or they had trouble giving the pain meds and were too embarrassed to call, or got bit by scruffing the cat and doing the technique that maybe someone, including myself, might've shown them 12 years ago. Right.
And I can't imagine being a layperson trying to medicate my animal.
Dude.
I've had times where like, seriously? I've had like drop eye drops from the ceiling and like just whatever I could think of. And so I always like, we make sure that we always tell people to like, call us back for anything. It doesn't matter what
open line of communication.
Get the medicine in the mouth.
Yeah.
If you don't understand how to get the cap off the syringe, anything, just let us know. We'll contact us forever to get them through this. But like so many people I think are also worried too. Like what I always learned on RAV strips too, is like they wake up how they go down. So if they're going under anesthesia as a struggle and a wrestle and a holding down and a masking, or
that is a very
anything scary, statement. That's how they wake up. So they kind of wake up how they go down. And sometimes it's going to seem like, okay, we gave them a ton of oral meds. We gave them an IM cocktail. We maybe had to give a top off of something IV. Then we did a local block. Then we did an anti-inflammatory. And some people are like, that's a lot of drugs, but it's not. It's the lower dose of all the drugs working kind of in conjunction. Then you don't see the same side effects as if we just gave him 20 mils of propofol on a high leg. So it just is so much easier to have them go down calmly. And they kind of just wake up like, I'm not sure where I'm at, but it's all right. There's a pillow
and then we're not getting euphoria or, I mean, I know so many texts I probably have. I mean, honestly, I can't think, I probably blocked out, but on recovery, which is a crucial time, whether we're a GP or a low cost pain neuter clinic, recovery is a very important time to be assessing those animals. But they come up and they start flailing and panicking, like you said. And then I get smacked in the face by a big, like a large dog head, or I get bit because they're terrified and like delirious, essentially.
We've done a lot of where we'll just like, we put catheters in them all so that if they need any post-op analgesics or dextromethorphan or anything, we'll cut the catheter. And then I will sometimes, if we didn't have a great success of getting them down, like if we're not sure we got all of the cocktail in the leg and then they're kind of wonky and we might not wake up well, I'll have the dextromethorphan ready and I can give it, flush it, cut it and pull it really quick. And so just so that they just don't even experience that at all. But if we're, whenever we've had anything that we've changed or done differently, or a case where we're like, this person mentioned this dog might've had a heart problem as a puppy, now we can't touch him, we will do regular rounds and then we will round about that dog in particular. So we all are like, okay, this is what's going on with this dog. This is what we can expect. We're all ready and we're all watching them all the way through. Same with any cat. It's like, we've had cats that have been sent with records of heart murmurs. And right. then by the time they get to us, we can't examine them. And we're just prepared, but we're not going to put, sometimes it's like, yes, we could use alfaxolone, but in some of these cats, that could be a large volume.
Right.
So we just have to critically think, like you said, this would be safer, but much more stressful. So we'll just try to think of different, and we can change things constantly. Like, we have a drug protocol for healthy spay neuter, but we can constantly change and tailor towards that cat and its condition and its behavior.
I love that, because I think we all know handling animals are individuals, but when it comes to anesthetic protocols, that's very true as well. So if we're using a similar protocol in all patients, that can be very concerning for a variety of reasons. So I love, and again, I learned tips and tricks from Robin. They are doing such amazing things, and I need to share, everyone needs to know how amazing they are. Everyone donate to Animal Fix Clinic, give them all your money. But thank you so much for everything you do. I'm definitely going to have Robin back to talk more about that common myth that we mentioned, and also lack of accessible care to many people. Especially right now with the pandemic, but prior to that, again, many veterinary technicians can't afford their animals' care, and they're amazing veterinary technicians and they love their animals very much. But to end on, we ended pretty positive. This whole thing was wonderful. But what is something that makes you happy? It could be all these beautiful stories you've told me. It could be that it was sunny today, something small, something big, no pressure.
For me, it's Beyonce.
Oh, snap.
I love Beyonce. So
I did not see that coming. See, I love it.
Anything Beyonce.
She has a new record, right?
Yeah, definitely.
She's not my jam. Like, I love Lizzo and a few other like popular music, but like, you know what I mean by that. But I've been hearing so much about her new record. I'm like, I need to listen to this.
I just really like, I like you said, we're both pretty passionate about what we're passionate about. And I feel like I see that in my Beyonce, and she is very passionate about what she does and has such a great work ethic and really great dance moves. And
she empowers the hell out of you. I love it.
Find Beyonce empowering.
I even find her empowering. I'm just like, I want to be like you. You make me want to be a better
What would
person.
Beyonce do?
Yep. Yes. What would Beyonce do? Well, thank you so much for being here, Robin. Send my love to the rest of the staff. I hope I can come visit you guys
anytime
soon, because, oh my God, I want to go and see all the amazing Yay. Stuff you're doing. And seriously, I can't express enough how amazing you are and how much joy you brought me.
And thanks seriously, for helping us do it.
Super mushy, but like, you were doing amazing work and inspire the fucking hell out of me.
Oh, thank you so much for helping us.
Thank you everyone for listening, and everyone who's recently reached out with positive feedback about the podcast. I really appreciate it. This is a passion project, so I appreciate all the love and kind comments that people have been giving me and the podcast. Please continue to share the podcast, leave a review, tell a friend, and have a wonderful day.